supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and boy, we got a lot to get done today. In the question of the week, we're going to answer a good half dozen questions about compost. How much sunlight does your pile need? Can you pour yeast into it? Can you do other things into it? We'll answer all of them later in the show. We're also going to talk to a leading proponent of combining fish, water, plants, and light to create something called aquaculture. It's going to be really cool. In the meantime, though, we better take some of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Long-time listener here in Center City, Philadelphia.
Okay. Whereabouts in Center City, Joe?
I live about four blocks southeast of City Hall.
All right. What can we do for Joe, who is mere blocks from the footprint of William Penn?
I have a Harry Lauder walking stick shrub in my yard. It's been there about 17 years.
Oh, is that the plant that you can't tell if it's alive or dead?
Well, that's close. It was recommended to me as winter interest, which I guess it is, but summertime it's not particularly pretty.
Right.
Last summer, I started out neglecting my garden because I was working on the house here, painting shutters and things like that.
Good for you.
And about halfway through the summer, I happened to look at this thing, and some kind of a tent insect had colonized it. At first, I thought it was the traditional tent caterpillar that I kind of grew up with in the suburbs here. I used to see them around.
Right.
But when I took a close look at it, and I'd say the nest was about the size of your fist, mm-hmm. there were these little tiny insects, the color of like a nutmeg, but smaller than a poppy seed, moving around inside.
Not any kind of little caterpillar.
No, which is what I expected. And the plant, if it looks bad to begin with, it looked even worse after this. It was kind of grayed out and all. So I cut out the tents, and I think I sprayed it with a safer insecticidal soap.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then I could see at the base of each leaf, there was like a little green bud. So I thought it would re-leaf, but
right.
it didn't. But it looks like for this summer, like these leaves are going to come out.
Okay.
So my question is there any way I could head off another infestation if you happen to know what this particular insect might be?
And they were moving around, like, rapidly.
Yes.
But it was not webbing. It was a nest.
It looked like a tent, you know. It had been...
See, because what I'm hearing is a cross between bagworms, tent caterpillars, fall webworms on one hand, and on the other hand, I'm thinking spider mites. You know, luckily in situations like this, you really don't need to know exactly what you're dealing with. I'm surprised that you decided to prune off the affected areas. Did you choose for some reason not to just, like, destroy the nest with your bare hands?
I don't exactly remember. I think I was so taken aback by it, I think there were three of these things on the tree, and I just cut the branch off.
And what time of year was this?
This thing's only about 5 feet tall. So,
right. What time of year did you do that?
It would have been just after midsummer.
Okay. Then we're starting to get to the time when you don't want to be pruning anything.
Right.
Okay. And you treated it with insecticidal soap afterwards?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Insecticidal soap and horticultural oils can be very effective treatments, but they must be sprayed on the insect to be effective. They have no residual action. So if you're spraying insecticidal soap on a leaf and you can't see any bugs, all you're doing is putting soap on the leaf.
Okay.
So that's not a good course of action. But the nest did not return.
Not last year.
Okay.
I'm a little concerned about this year.
No. This year you're going to keep an eye on it. And if you see any signs of insects, do you have a hose out there?
Oh, yeah.
And do you have a nozzle that has multiple settings?
I do.
You know, even before you see any signs of insects, once a week, just take that hose, set the nozzle to the strongest laser beam setting, the tiniest shot of water that comes out the hardest. And starting at the bottom of the plant, just give it a good washdown from the bottom all the way up. Cradle the plant in one hand, because you said it's all approachable. It's like 5-6 feet tall.
Yes.
And then really blast it with the water. That should remove any signs of these insects. If they do return and try to get established, that will knock them off before they could set up any kind of tents. Failing that, that's what I would have told you to do if you had called last summer.
Mm-hmm.
I would have told you to blast the tents off of there with water, and then if you saw any little guys that had survived the blast off with water, to spray them with insecticidal soap or even a light horticultural oil, and then to rinse down the plant a couple hours later, because oils and soaps only work by smothering the pest insect. So after 20 minutes to an hour after you spray the plant, any insects you got are dead. You might as well wash the stuff off because there is, no residual effect. But I predict you're never going to see these bugs again.
Well, I hope not.
All right, Joe?
All right. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Good luck with your stick.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bernadette, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Bernadette. Where are you?
I'm in Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Very good. Just outside of Philly. What can we do for you?
I had an issue last summer that I'd like to avoid this summer. For some reason, the slugs from my garden went into the drain from my air conditioning unit.
Oh.
And blocked it.
Yes.
I came home one afternoon, and my pergo floor had been lifted from the water that backed up from the air conditioner.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so are we talking a whole house air conditioner or a window?
Yes, mm-hmm. My whole house air conditioner.
And it drains outside?
Yes, it drains out into the garden, under the floor and into the garden.
Okay, so you designed it that way.
That's the way it was when I bought the house.
Really?
I don't have a basement.
That's unusual. We have two different central systems because our house has just been, started out as a little house and has just been endlessly renovated.
Mm-hmm.
And the drains for the systems go into the big wash tubs that are in the basement.
Right.
And the guys who installed the systems and the guys who have come to repair the systems said, make sure once a month you come down in the summertime and make sure water is dripping out.
Mm-hmm.
Because somewhere up in the top of your house somewhere there's an air handling mechanism. That's where the different ductwork comes out to take the air conditioning to different rooms of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the sweat originates. That's where all the moisture the air conditioner is taking out of the air. That's where it first forms into water. And there's a big swimming pool underneath your giant exchanger unit, which is this big boxy thing with all these vents coming out of it. And the drain, typically using a PVC pipe, takes that water down. Sometimes it just drops it right down into your wastewater system. But since it's going outside, I'm surprised that they didn't screen it off to begin with. Because another thing that happens, this is not the first I've heard of this.
Oh, really? Good.
But the last time I heard about it, it was a little snake got in there.
Oh, please.
A little garter snake that was crawled in during the early spring before the system was really functioning and blocked it up that way. So there's a million things that can go wrong. So you want to do two separate things. First, you want to just get what's called hardware cloth, like a fine mesh screening, and put that over the bottom of the pipe so that the hole is not open. And then, to keep slugs away, you want to get some copper flashing, which is like the stuff they use on the roof to separate out the chimneys from the shingles.
Right, right.
And wrap the pipe with copper flashing. Because I'm afraid that even if you do make the pipe kind of slug-proof, something else can get into that opening. So you want to screen it off with fine screening that'll let the water come out, but that won't let any little toads or or mice would want to go up in there. Oh. And then wrap the pipe for going about a foot up with copper. And if you want to go for the gold, underneath where the pipe comes out, make a kind of a little coppery thing. Or maybe even buy some, like, little copper boxy thing for the garden. Slugs can't touch copper.
Well, that sounds good. I appreciate your information and, you know, being able to bounce my ideas off you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. We like being a, now we're a home improvement show, too.
Well, I really enjoy your show, and thank you.
All right. Thank you, Bernadette. Take care.
Okay, you take care of yourself. Okay,
bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be appearing on Saturday, April 26th at the Prince William Virginia Compost Facility in the morning and at the Green Street Gardens Alexandria location in the afternoon. And then on Sunday, the 27th, I'll appear at Green Street's original location just outside of Annapolis. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, growing plants and fish together, and answers to an almost infinite series of questions about compost. I'm Infinite Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, many of you have questions about clumpy, wet compost, what's wrong with it, and whether you can use yeast or maybe even some other interesting things in your compost pile. We're going to answer lots of those questions at the end of the show. But now it is time to talk about gardening with Aquaman. We're going to be talking about growing plants and fish together in the very interesting system known as aquaculture. It is time to welcome our guest, Sylvia Bernstein, author of the new book, Aquaponic Gardening, a step-by-step guide to raising vegetables and fish together, and it comes by New Society Publishers. who I believe have an association with Mother Earth News. And Sylvia joins us through the studios of Colorado Public Radio. Thank you for that. Sylvia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. Excited to be here.
I am excited to have you here. We get a lot of questions about hydroponics and aquaponics, and you've had a foot in both. I will tell you that I have never been a fan of hydroponics, which may make common sense because coming from Organic Gardening magazine, our whole theory, our whole raison is building up soil, is building up soil life. And the idea of gardening in water alone just, you know, never appealed to me. And then it seemed like all of the hydroponic setups required chemical fertilizers of one kind or another. So that made them real easy to avoid when you were organic. Aquaponics is a whole different animal, you have to say, because now instead of plants growing in water, you've got this whole kind of like indoor crazy permaculture thing going on, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's a, at its surface, it's a blend of aquaculture and hydroponics, but in a lot of ways, it's very different from hydroponics, just like you've pointed out. It's kind of an organic version of hydroponics, if you will, but even more than that, ultimately, our grow beds are, it's kind of hard to differentiate between them and really good organic soil.
Now, aquaponics in its most simple form is you got fishies swimming around in water, and on top of the fishies, you have plants growing, and on top of that, you got a light source. Is that it stripped down to its most basic?
Yes, absolutely. And the light source is really, if you're out in outside or in a greenhouse, that's the sun. So it's only if you're going to be indoors, and that kind of applies to any gardening system indoors. The thing that really makes aquaponics unique is the fishies and the plants. And in between the two is actually an invisible hero, which is your nitrifying beneficial bacteria. So without those bacteria, actually, the whole thing wouldn't work. The bacteria convert the sort of toxic, useless, ammonia-based waste from the fish into an incredible fertilizer for the plants, a nitrate-based fertilizer. The plants now take up that fertilizer and clean the water for the fish.
Now,
so it's this tremendous symbiosis between these two.
Is this similar to the naturally occurring bacteria that many gardeners will soon treat their peas, beans, and other legumes with that allows the roots of plants to take nitrogen out of the air?
You know, honestly, I'm not sure that that's the case. With this, and believe me, I'm not a chemist at all, just from my understanding, though, about this what's going on here is that this is a bacteria that exists in water systems. So if you've got a pond in your yard or a lake or river, wherever you see sort of a tan-colored slime on the rocks, that's this bacteria. There's two kinds. There's one called, Nitrosomonas bacteria that takes ammonia and creates a nitrite out of it. And then there's a second one that comes along and takes up that nitrite and makes it into nitrates.
Oh, so you need both of them.
So this duo is what does it.
You need
both
of them.
Yeah, you need both of them.
Okay. And slime is good in your world.
We love slime. We love bacteria, fungus, the whole enchilada.
So let's jump into a mid-size system. I have whatever your version of an aquarium tank is, and then I've got the right thing to sit on top of it that holds the substrate and everything. And I'm growing, I've decided, lettuces and herbs on top of that. Now, I've either got it in a heated greenhouse or I got, you know, big lights on top of it. My first question is, what feeds the fish? Do I have to feed the fish or is this a total closed system?
You need to feed the fish. So we refer to aquaponics really as a mostly closed system. It's, mm-hmm. it's almost there. Something's got to be feeding those fish. And there definitely are people out there that are working on trying to sort of close that loop and be able to grow the food for the fish. And depending on the kind of fish that you're growing, you can certainly supplement their diet with things that you can be growing within your system. Duckweed, water lettuce, worms, black soldier fly larvae, those are all things that people are raising and feeding their fish. The problem is I have not yet seen a totally closed system that kind of strikes me as almost a perpetual energy machine that doesn't seem to be happening.
Now, in this aquarium, what do we got? Do we have bubblers? Do we have to purify the water? We have to add oxygen to it, right?
We do have to add oxygen. Now, you can design aquaponic systems so that you actually don't have to add an external bubbler to it. Anytime that you have water hitting water, so if the water, for example, comes out of the grow bed and falls back into the aquarium from some height, or you send it through a pipe where it's going to come in through multiple holes, then you're adding oxygen into your water.
Right, you're just picking it up out of the air.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, you know, it's just self-aerating at that point. So really the main things that an aquaponic system needs is a fish tank, a grow bed, a pump to move the water between the two, plumbing to connect them, and some sort of a growing substrate up in the grow bed.
Which I believe, if I read correctly in your book, the thing you like right now is a really compressed clay.
Yes, it's something referred to as expanded clay.
Mm-hmm.
It's really light and porous, so it'll hold that wonderful yummy bacteria and oxygen and water. Plus, they've been rounded. So it makes it really nice to sort of dig your hands in there and work in it.
Now,
we like that.
You mentioned these two different bacteria that are necessary to turn the fish poop into like the perfect plant food.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that's going to be naturally occurring? Is this something you add once? Is it something you add once a week, once a year? What's up with the bacteria?
It is naturally occurring. So it's present in the air, it's present in the water, surfaces of the water. So if you have a supply of ammonia, it will find you. You know, build it and it will come. But it might take a little longer than you might want. And so what most people starting their aquaponic systems will do is they'll goose their system with some external amount of that bacteria. Either you can buy it in bottled form, you can go down to a lake and get a slimy rock.
If you that's your idea of a good time, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Are you serious that you could be a student of slime, SOS,
mm-hmm.
and you could go down to like the local pond, and you want stuff for your tank anyway. I mean, what are you going to fill it up with, little sunken pirate ships? You could actually pick out the right rocks and inoculate the bacteria that way?
Yeah.
That would be cool. Now, there's nothing more natural than that. I presume the type and size and number of the plants is limited only by the size of your system?
That's exactly correct, with two exceptions.
You're not growing sweet corn, huh?
We have.
Oh,
actually,
okay. Never mind.
I've got pictures of 8-foot-tall corn stalks in a system we had outdoors last year. It was pretty silly looking, actually.
What are the
two
exceptions?
The two exceptions. One is that we keep these systems at a pH of about neutral.
Mm-hmm.
We shoot for 6, 8, 7, right around there.
Gotcha. So you're not growing blueberries.
Exactly. Anything that's an acid lover isn't going to be too happy in here. The other thing that's not going to be real happy is anything that's sort of deeply subterranean. So your potatoes,
right,
onions.
Root crops.
Eh, not so much.
Okay.
But things that are more shallow root crop, radishes and beets, for example, do
you can get
great
away with
in these
as long
systems.
As your
yeah.
as long as your substrate is deep enough.
Yeah. Well, and plus they sort of in my experience, they push themselves up and out of those clay pebbles.
Hmm.
And they grow just fine.
Now, do people eat the fish? Some do, some don't. Is one of the points that the fish are also getting big in there, and at some point they get harvested? Do they have babies in the tank? Do you have to replace
them?
Yes,
they do. Yes, they do. So depending on the type of fish you get, there's no rule that says you have to eat the fish, but it's a nice benefit if you have a bigger system, for sure. And people are growing tilapia.
I was going to say tilapia. And again, this can be a small tank in an apartment, or it can be a farming fishing enterprise the size of a city block.
Yes. Yes, it's a growing technique, so it can be applied to as little as a 1 gallon aquarium and a single plant all the way up to a commercial farm.
Well, you have piqued a lot of interests out there. Sylvia Bernstein has been our guest. The book is Aquaponic Gardening, a step-by-step guide to raising vegetables and fish together. It is from New Society Publishers. Mother Earth News endorses it. So how bad could it be? Sylvia Bernstein is the president and founder of the Aquaponic Source. She is an internationally recognized expert on aquaponic gardening. You can find out more about her at aquaponicgardening.com. Sylvia, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Mike. It's been a real pleasure.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carmela, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carmela. How are you?
Very good.
And where is Carmela very good?
In Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Okay. What can we do you for?
I have a question about corn gluten. We usually apply it to our grass every spring and fall,
mm-hmm.
but last fall we seeded our grass with some success. Some areas didn't have very much success. But
now, what time of year did you seed it?
In the fall.
Well, that's a big time stretch. The ideal time, for instance, to put down new grass seed for a cool season lawn is between August 15th and September 15th.
We were probably somewhere around mid to end September.
Okay, that should still have worked out well. Did you spread anything for the seed, like compost or topsoil?
We did in some areas, yeah. Some areas that aren't working are those that have some water runoff issues. We're on a hill.
Oh, okay. Yeah, grass is never going to do well in areas that don't drain well.
Right, and then we have issues with deer trampling some areas, too. So
that should not be a problem. Deer typically can't impact, again, unless the area is so soggy.
Yeah,
that the deer are acting like dogs. I fear long term, and I know this isn't your question, this coming fall, you might want to work on remediating the moisture if you really want a lawn there.
Yeah, we have a plan for that. We just have to put it in action.
Once you do that, then a lawn that you sow in late August, early September should do fabulous.
So what we're wondering is whether we should be applying the corn gluten this spring.
Did you have any crabgrass last year?
Oh, sure.
Okay. See, one of the issues is the timing, of course. Crabgrass germinates at a soil temperature of 55 degrees, which is generally when forsythia blooms. So if you live in an area where the forsythia has not yet fully bloomed, or you can stick a soil thermometer down and it's not yet at 55 or hasn't been at 55 for a couple days, by all means, yes. Because if you had crabgrass last year, it dropped a lot of seed. And if you spread seed last fall and some of it hasn't come up, and you did it before the soil temperature got too cold, it's not coming up. It's been washed away, or it's been eaten by mice or voles or something like that. Now, there are also people who will say that even if you miss the timing window and it gets too late to prevent the germination of crabgrass, you should still give your lawn a gentle spring feeding with corn gluten meal, ideally, just to give it the strength to try to outcompete the crabgrass as we get to the summer. But the ideal situation is to make sure our old drainage issues are taken care of, have a nice, rich bed out there to receive the seed, put the seed down August to September, and then if you get the corn gluten in place the following spring at the right time and prevent the germination of crabgrass seed, then you should have a full, lush lawn over that summer, and literally that should be the end of your crabgrass problems.
So the corn gluten should go down before the forsythia bloom?
Yes.
Well, ours haven't bloomed yet, so we're still in good shape.
Okay.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Good luck, Carmela.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. You take care.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that Earth Day is right around the corner, Tuesday, April 22nd. And one thing you can do for Earth Day is recycle some of your electronic equipment instead of even thinking about putting it out in the trash. Your local community may hold recycling events, and Best Buy has reminded us that they take a lot of old electronic equipment to recycle safely. So for Earth Day coming up, maybe plant a tree, but definitely take some of that old equipment that you were going to throw away and put it into the proper recycling hands to save this wonderful planet of ours. But don't you go saving that planet just yet, because we'll be right back with lots of answers to your composting questions and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the Knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4. A cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, which is many questions about composting. You're not going to believe how many answers we're going to deliver in a short period of time, but you will believe it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Richard, how are you today, sir?
I'm well.
Where are you, man?
I'm in Sir Goinsville, Tennessee.
Okay. So are you in the Tri-Cities area?
I am indeed.
Okay, very good, very good. Always a pleasure to hear from our friends down there. So what can we do for you, Rich?
Well, sir, I want to plant a Japanese maple. I'm curious, is there a specific type for my area, and what do I need to do to make this tree successful?
Well, you know, the fact that they're Japanese maples means that you're not going to get, you know, a native. There are maple trees that are native to the United States, but you like the color, the Japanese maple, the ornamentality, right?
Oh, yes, of course.
First, with any tree, is buy a nice, healthy-looking specimen. So go to a good independent garden center. I know you've got lots of good garden centers in your area. And pick out a nice tree. It's probably going to be bald and burlapped. Ideally, depending on the size of the tree you're buying, if you're buying a tree that's already got some good size to it, which I think is a great idea, see if they'll deliver it for you. And okay. Then when you plant it, all of the old advice is wrong. Everything everyone will tell you is wrong. You should remove all of the wrappings if it's bald and burlapped. You want to get rid of any wire cages, any plastic strings, and you want to get rid of that burlap. The planting hole itself should not be overly deep, but it should be as wide as you can make it. And when I say not overly deep, when you put the tree into the planting hole the first time to see if it's the right depth,
uh-huh.
I want the root flare to be above ground. In other words, you can't have a lollipop sticking out of the ground. You want to see the top of the root structure always above ground. That makes for the absolute healthiest trees.
And now that I did not know.
Yes, people plant trees much too deeply. And what happens is if the true trunk of the tree, the bottom of the lollipop, let's call it, is buried below ground, voles and insects and mildews and rots will eat away at it. And once that bark is ruined in a complete circle, the tree will die. And you won't see any evidence as to why, because all this will go on underground. Whereby if you show the root flare above ground, that healthy musculature of where the tree reaches out with its uppermost roots,
right.
Then that protects the bark completely. It actually helps the tree breathe and get more air into its root system, which it needs. And despite what other people will tell you, you do not want to improve the soil in the planting hole. You're not going to put any nice compost or peat moss or topsoil or anything good in the planting hole. You're going to refill it with the same soil you dug out because that's the soil the roots are going to have to fight their way through and grow through. And if you put them down in a nice little island of soil, they're going to stay in that nice little island. Starting 6 inches away from the trunk, you want to put down a mulch of 1 to 2 inches of compost. Not touching the trunk, but going out as far as the widest part of the hole you dug. That will improve the soil slowly every time it rains. Every time it rains, the tree will get a nice dose of compost tea. And that's what you want to do every year. You want to keep wood mulch away from these trees. They're very sensitive to it. If for any reason you can't find compost, you can use pine straw. I know that's widely available down in your community. Now, you don't want this thing to broil in the sun all day long or get too much shade.
Yeah, I've got the perfect spot in the backyard for it.
Okay, good. And don't plant it near a pavement. Shield it from any winds. And it is one of the first plants in your landscape to get some water when you haven't had rain for a week. These roots tend to stay shallow. So if you go a week without rain, just take a hose out to the base of the tree and let it drip, drip, drip at the base of the tree for an hour or two to really saturate the soil. Don't water it daily and frequently, but when you do water it deeply.
I think the only other question I would have, should I stake the tree?
No. Literally, if you look at how anybody else plants trees, do the opposite and you'll do fine.
All right.
Nature never put trees in bondage and neither should you.
I'll remember that.
All right, Richard. Good luck, man.
All right, Mike. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Ann, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Mike.
Well, thank you for making it, Ann. Where are you?
I'm in Media in a senior citizen retirement community, and we have a community garden, and I have a question for you.
Okay, very good. I'm glad to hear that such a community has a community garden.
Yes, we've won 2 years in a row. We haven't won recently, and I think it might be because of the weeds. So that was why I was calling.
Okay.
Well, it's all completely fenced in to keep out the critters.
Right.
But then there's a lot of weeds right at the fence.
Right.
And this was what we wanted to control. The head of our garden committee decided that we should use this organic weed killer.
Okay.
And I wanted to know, and he wanted to know, if it's safe, if it leached into the garden. It's 1 gallon of vinegar, 1 cup of salt, 2 tablespoons of liquid soap.
Oh, so this is not an organic weed killer. This is a concoction that somebody found on the internet.
Yes, but he felt it was organic.
Well, yeah, I mean, what they've done, all vinegar, salt, and some forms of soap are all traditional non-chemical herbicides. Combining them might seem like a good idea. It doesn't sound like a good one to me. Now, let's go further. So we've got fencing with a lawn on one side.
Yes.
And on the other side, we have a garden. Inside the garden, are there raised beds?
No, we have never done raised beds, and probably would be a good idea.
I was going to say, what prevents the lawn from just creeping forward and destroying your gardening efforts?
Well, every year, the gentleman who is the sort of the president of our group, he tills the entire garden.
And do you know that adds 95% of the weeds?
Yep.
Okay.
So I had my garden moved up to the far end of the lots, and I told him not to till my garden. Because last year, I had weeds that were 3 foot high.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we can't tell people this enough at this time of the year. When you till, you expose all these dormant weed seeds to the trigger for germination, which is sunlight, and then you cover them over again and you feed and water them. And those weeds would not have been there if you hadn't tilled. The only reason that people need to till is because they've been walking on the soil all previous season, and the soil's become too compressed for healthy plant roots. So by simply dividing the garden up into 4 by 8 foot sections, raised beds, filling those beds with nice soil, there'll never be any need to till because people won't step into those beds. They want to compress the soil in the walking lanes. Don't till those. The people just tromping around will keep the weeds down. And that's a sustainable system. I don't think you can have a garden adjacent to a lawn that's a flat earth garden and ever be doing anything by fighting weeds. And what's the point of having a garden if that's all you do all summer long is fight weeds? And your concern with the weeds around the fencing,
yes,
is just what to do with it, not the fact that the grass is creeping through to the rest of the garden?
Right, right.
Well, full-strength vinegar is an organic herbicide. Salt, you don't want to be salting your soil.
No, that's what we were afraid of.
Yeah, but I think the bigger issue here is the weeds inside the garden, which are really time-consuming. If you're definitely going to stick with the flat earth garden, after he's done tilling, you want to level the soil well and water it every day, and then after 2 weeks, go out with a hoe and just slice off all the new weeds at the soil line. But I would say, in terms of the weeds growing around the fencing, how strong is the fencing? What's it made of?
Oh, it's cyclone fence. It's wonderful.
Why don't you just have somebody weed whack it?
Yeah, that's an idea.
Get a cordless, rechargeable weed whacker and go around it. That way, you know, because this stuff gets expensive sooner or later, spraying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether it's soap, whether it's salt, whether it's vinegar, you always want to make sure it doesn't get in people's eyes. Salt will ruin the soil, whereby a weed whacker will just knock the grass to the ground, and you do that once a month, and everything's fine.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll suggest that.
All right. Good luck, Ann.
Okay. Thanks an awful lot. I appreciate your help, Mike.
My pleasure.
Okay. Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for an especially fast-paced question of the week, Compost Q&A. Chunks, clips, chicks, yeast, and urine? Oh, my. Alexis Landis, read us the first of many, many questions we're going to get to right now.
Okay, let's go. We heard from Jess in Laverne, Tennessee, who writes, "My pile is squidgy, has big chunks of stuff in it, and doesn't resemble dirt as much as I would like. I've got coffee grounds, kitchen waste, and leaves in there, unshredded as I'm lazy. It does get turned when the weather is nice."
Well, to misquote Rick from Casablanca, you're not lazy, just misinformed. Turning is work. It's much easier to shred those leaves in the fall as you build your pile and then just turn it once when you collect the finished compost in the spring. Whole leaves take forever to break down, and adding too much kitchen waste will always make the process slower and those clumps bigger.
We also heard from Fawn in Portland, Oregon, who writes, "I listen to your podcast and love it. Recently, my neighbors, who have an urban farm with goats, ducks, and chickens, gave me some of their composting piles of manure and straw bedding. But the compost is wet and clumpy, very different from my worm castings and the compost I've purchased from stores. Should I plop the mud-like clumps of compost around my plants, or try and dry it out first?"
Well, what you have are piles of manure, not compost. Quote, "Yard waste compost can be achieved by mixing a little manure in with the shredded fall leaves, but just barnyard manure in its bedding equals composted manure. And that phrase only applies if it's fully composted, which yours is clearly not. You should never use any kind of manure that's still even partially raw. So let those big piles sit for a while, turning them a few times if you're able. When it looks like the kind of finished material you're used to, mix it half and half with your worm castings or some regular compost to balance out the nutrients. Manure from birds is so nitrogen-rich it can inhibit fruiting. If you use it straight, it'll grow a 30-foot-high tomato plant with 3 tomatoes on it."
And now BJ from Oriental, North Carolina writes, "I have some yeast that passed its expiration date and was wondering if it should go into the compost bin."
Absolutely, especially if that bin is mostly filled with shredded leaves. Yeast is alive with the kind of organisms that naturally move the composting process along. So mix that yeast into all parts of the pile and make sure that the, quote, "dry browns" are good and moist as you're mixing. Turning the pile and mixing the yeast in as you go would be doubly ideal.
I can't believe that we're up to our fourth question already. We are cooking faster than a well-made pile. Josh in Northern Florida writes, "I just watched Mike's TEDx talk on composting on YouTube and learned so much. But I'm hungry for knowledge on this subject and have a few follow-up questions. Number one, how much sunlight should a black plastic compost tumbler get each day?"
Well, in my experience, sunlight doesn't really seem to matter much, whether you're talking about an open pile, a sealed bin, a drum, or a tumbler. It's having the right mix of ingredients and moisture levels that counts.
Number two, how much coffee ground should I use in relation to leaves?
Well, you should always remember that well-shredded leaves alone will make very good compost. Adding some nitrogen in the form of coffee grounds makes it happen faster and gives you a richer finished product. Quote, how much generally depends on the volume of grounds that you have easily available. But I would not exceed a 5-gallon bucket's worth of grounds per 4 cubic feet of shredded leaves.
And number three, should I continue to add more grounds and leaves as the pile reduces in size, or let one batch finish completely and then start another?
It's always best to make single batches at a time. If you keep mixing materials into a single pile, you'll never get completely finished compost to use.
And number four, can I use grass clippings and brown leaves from plants that aren't trees?
an emphatic no to the grass clippings. Removing clippings from a lawn starves the lawn of the nutrients it needs. And if that lawn was treated with herbicides, the resulting compost can kill garden plants. But yes to brown leaves that aren't from trees. Not everybody has lots of deciduous trees to supply the necessary dry brown material to make good compost. So they have to be creative, like the folks who shred up old palm tree leaves in Florida and Southern California.
And finally, Jordan in San Francisco, who also loved your TEDx talk, writes, do you have any thoughts on using human urine in a compost pile or directly on plants?
Well, no to direct use on plants. Urine is very high in nitrogen and could actually burn the plants. And urine can be very salty. Using urine directly on plants is not allowed in organic agriculture in Europe, for instance. But if you're free of infection and not taking prescription medications, I see no harm in peeing into a pile of well-shredded leaves to provide some nitrogen. It should have pretty much the same beneficial effect as coffee grounds or animal manures, but not too much because of the potential for salt buildup. Well, that sure was a lot of questions about compost answered in a shockingly short period of time now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with lots more information about a lot of the topics we just discussed, click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to confiscate my compost if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuge, teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. As always, should you choose to send us an email,
please, please tell us where you live. Oh, please, please put it in the email, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin Love Train Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is Marissa Nicosia. I'm Mike McGrath. I think I'll step outside and add a little nitrogen to my pile and be back in time to see you again next week. Although many people focus on kitchen waste, you can't make good compost without a lot of dry brown materials in the mix. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, I'll explain how to make compost without fall leaves, plus answers to all your growing questions.